Stay tuned for Off the Hook coming up. But before we do that, well, come on, folks. You know what I'm about to say at this point. You know what I'm going to do. I'm just going to make a quick appeal to the listening audience of what you just heard about the myriad of reasons why WBAI needs to be supported because of the voices, the various voices out here. Say what they want to say. And sometimes people will like it, and sometimes people won't like it, but it has been said. Okay? I was saying plenty of things off the air, but I can't tell you because it was off the air. But trust me, y'all wouldn't have liked it. But with that said, 212-209-2950, we're going to give to WBAI.org online. All right. Enough of me dilly-dallying. Stay tuned for Off the Hook coming up. It is 7 p.m.
Due to the earthquake in the area you are calling, your call cannot be completed at this time. Please try your call later. 078P.
If you'd like to make a call, please hang up and try again. If you need help, stay on the line and a hacker will assist you shortly.
Good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this Wednesday evening, joined tonight by Kyle. I say joined tonight by Kyle.
Yes.
And by Alex over in Skype land.
Good evening.
Apparently you're in an echo tube of some sort. You know, I want to dive right into it. Okay, first of all, I had nothing to do with it. We're talking about all the leaked documents that are suddenly popping up everywhere. That show all kinds of Pentagon classified information. I just would like to go around the rooms as it were, so that we can right away eliminate any possibility of our connection. So I already said I'm clean. Kyle?
Yeah, I'm clean.
You sure about that? You sound a little uncertain.
I have no. This has nothing to do with me.
No, you're not clean.
Leave me out of this. Wow. No, I don't even know what's going on.
I'd make a good prosecutor. Alex.
Nadia.
Rob? Gila? Silence. Okay. All right. I guess you do have the right. Oh, they're not in this week. Okay. Could they be on a jet flying to Tahiti or something as we speak? Or we'll talk about it afterwards. Okay. Well, the point is, we don't know who did it. We don't know who did it, but we do know that this is driving people crazy. What do we know so far? Well, these are classified documents which have not actually been authenticated by U.S. officials. They're everything from briefing slides that map out Ukrainian military positions to assessments of international support for Ukraine, and other sensitive topics, including under what circumstances Russian President Vladimir Putin might use nuclear weapons. So that's a fun read for anybody. We don't know how many documents were leaked. Associated Press has viewed approximately 50 documents, and some estimates put the total number in the hundreds. Now, nobody knows where they came from. They were somewhere in the web. And where exactly and who had access at that point, we don't know. We simply don't know, said Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin as he banged his fist on the table repeatedly. We will continue to investigate and turn over every rock until we find the source of this and the extent of it. There was a really good summation of this on a site called Bellingcat.com, based in the Netherlands. From Discord to 4chan, the improbable journey of a U.S. intelligence leak. In recent days, the U.S. Justice Department and Pentagon have been investigating an apparent online leak of sensitive documents, including some that were marked top secret. A portion of the documents, which have since been widely covered by the news media, focused on Russia's invasion of Ukraine, while others detailed analysis of potential U.K. policies on the South China Sea, the activities of a Houthi figure in Yemen. The existence of the documents was first reported by the New York Times after a number of Russian Telegram channels shared five photographed files related to the invasion of Ukraine on April 5th, at least one of which has since been found by Bellingcat to be crudely edited. Yeah. Now, these documents seem to be dated in early March, around the time they were first posted online on Discord, which, in case you don't know, it's a messaging platform popular with gamers. Keep in mind that date. Early March is when they were posted. Now, Bellingcat has seen evidence that some documents dated to January could have been posted online even earlier, although it's unclear exactly when. Bellingcat also spoke to three members of the Discord community where the images had been posted, who claimed that many more documents had been shared across other Discord servers in recent months. As the channels were deleted following the controversy generated by the leaked documents, Bellingcat has not been able to confirm this particular claim. But bizarrely, in case this isn't bizarre enough, the Discord channels in which the documents dated from March were posted were focused on the Minecraft computer game and fandom for a Filipino YouTube celebrity. They then spread to other sites, such as the image board 4chan, before appearing on Telegram and Twitter, and then major media publishers around the world afterwards took interest. You notice the major media publishers are the last. They were, Minecraft had it first, then Telegram, then Twitter. Russian presidential spokesperson Dmitry Peskov told CNN that the documents showed the extent of U.S. and NATO involvement in Ukraine, yet one pro-Russian Telegram channel that has been providing updates on the conflict wasn't convinced and said it was possible the documents could be Western disinformation. None of the documents that Bellingcat, what we're reading from right now, had seen were scanned. None of the documents were scanned. They were all photographed. You can see creases on the documents with items such as a hunter's scope box and some Gorilla Glue visible in the background of those dated from early March. This appears to indicate that at least some of the documents were photographed in the same location. The content of the shared documents ranges widely, with some topics including maps of hotspots in Ukraine, such as Bakhmut and Kharkiv, a delivery timetable for Western munitions to Ukraine, as well as maps and catalogs of Ukrainian air defense assets, including a calendar of ammunition expenditures. A CIA Operations Center intelligence update marked top secret from March 2nd is also included in the images, although much of the information in these documents had previously been publicly available through media reports. While it has yet not been possible to uncover the original source of these apparent leaks, it has been possible to trace the spread of the documents over a variety of internet forums in recent months before they were reported by pro-Russian Telegram channels and then major media outlets. Fascinating story and fascinating accounts of all this. In fact, one of the stories being related has to do with somebody getting into an argument on one of these, I believe on one of the Discord channels, and then simply posting a bunch of classified information to back up their argument and say, look, this proves what I was saying. And then the rest is history, I guess. Alex, you know a thing or two about leaks, about how the military handles these things and what they must be going through right now. What are your initial impressions of this?
This is such a fascinating story on I think just so many levels, too. I mean, the idea of these documents being out there for about a month before anybody really noticed them is just so strange, number one. You know, the idea that they're distributed through Discord is so strange, too. I mean, ordinarily you would think if somebody had a bucket of top-secret documents that they wanted to get out into the wild, they wouldn't just post them in some kind of random or seemingly random Discord server, right? You would probably send them over to WikiLeaks if you wanted to get them published, or the New York Times, the AP, Reuters. There are lots of other alternative outlets where you could, and very securely as well, share information. I mean, there are things, you know, 2600 has a secure drop instance, right? And so it allows people to securely share documents with the magazine. The New York Times has secure drop. This is something that I believe, you know, our dear friend and whose anniversary, unfortunately, just recently came up, Aaron Swartz was instrumental in putting together secure drop, right? So it allows people with these types of documents to share them securely with media organizations. But yet whoever had these documents didn't do that. Maybe they didn't trust the system. Maybe they weren't technically sophisticated. But for whatever reason, they ended up you know, in a Discord channel, you know, where gamers go and hang out. You know, another option here, something we saw obviously with the 2016 election, was, you know, passing documents of this type over to WikiLeaks. And in more recent times, our dear friends over at Distributed Denial of Secrets have become a major repository of leaked documents, especially with respect to Russia and the Ukraine war. So I find it very, very odd that the source of these documents is in Discord. The other thing that's interesting about Discord, too, is, insofar as I can tell, it's a U.S. company. So that means that the original documents, if they were shared with Discord, you know, once they've been processed by Discord and, let's say, put out there for anybody to download and then they're downloaded, you're going to lose all, well, I would say most of the metadata that's associated with those documents is going to be destroyed or disrupted in some way by virtue of the processing of those images on the Discord servers. But Discord, having received the original files themselves, are going to be in possession of all of the metadata if they have the, if they still have those original files. So the metadata associated with these original images is very likely in the possession of Discord, and you can guarantee that as a San Francisco-based company, they are very likely dealing with FBI and DOJ and search warrants, all kinds of interesting things going on there with respect to the investigation of the source of these leaks. So I think a lot is going to shake out over the next few months. I wouldn't expect anything to move extraordinarily quickly here, at least with respect to information coming into the public domain. But I do think over the next few months, things are going to shake out as this investigation moves forward and we learn a little bit more about the motivations and the aspirations of these particular leaks.
Alex, are you in traffic or not? You're in your office, aren't you?
I'm, yeah. Right. I mean, it's just, this is Manhattan.
It's Manhattan.
The hazards of the city, yes.
Well, that's something.
Yeah.
That's something.
Yeah, it's coming back to life.
Well, speaking of Discord, this is the part I was looking for before. This happened on March 4th, which was about a month before the Telegram and 4chan posts. 10 documents were posted in a Discord server called Minecraft Earth Map. I guess none of us were monitoring that. We should have been, but we weren't. Minecraft is a popular computer game with millions of players around the world. This is the interesting part. After a brief spat with another person on the server about Minecraft maps and the war in Ukraine, one of the Discord users replied, "Here, have some leaked documents," attaching 10 documents about Ukraine, some of which bore the top secret markings.
Yeah, I think the nonchalant nature, I mean, first of all, there is going to be a time frame to reassemble that kind of window from when these documents were created and then when they were ultimately made public. But the thing that's really interesting in the leak in this platform, particularly in being nonchalant in that way, seems like it could be a form of subterfuge as well. Like, you don't know. It may be deliberate that it's not on, like, one of the formal organizations that Alex had described. That may be something that is deliberate. And the language just in that phrase, here have some leaked documents, tells me it's possible it's been through a couple set of hands, because if you were leaking them just then, would you describe them as already having been leaked? You know?
Well, just, you know, based on previous involvement in hacker adventures over the decades, sometimes there's a trove of documents that everybody knows about except the authorities, you know, so that when somebody finally is caught up to by the law, and they're all in a tizzy about, oh my God, they had this, they had that, you know, people in the hacker community are like, yeah, everyone had that. You know, the Netcom files come to mind. All sorts of
curiosities.
Yeah, the things that people just kind of collect. They might not even use it, but it's just something that's floating around. Well, apparently this was floating around, and intelligence, governments didn't know about it. Now, this is kind of interesting, too. I like your opinion on this, Alex. There was one image in common between the Telegram and 4chan post, which was a map that showed a number of statistics, including the cumulative number of KIA, that's killed in action, soldiers on the Russian and Ukrainian sides through the course of the war. However, the numbers on these two sources differed, with the first source, 4chan, showing more Russian losses than Ukrainian, and the second source, Donbas Devushka, the reverse. A closer examination of the second image, with the much higher Ukrainian killed in action numbers, and that was posted on Telegram, shows crude image manipulation. As well as the later posting time and far blurrier resolution, the numbers are out of alignment. Space between some numbers and letters is also too large to be consistent with the font. So therefore, seems that either the Donbas Devushka Telegram account or a previous source posted by this account altered the original image to paint the Ukrainian losses as heavier than in the original assessment. So it seems that there was a leaked document, and then somebody crudely tried to alter that leaked document to make it seem more beneficial for the Russian side. What do you think about that, Alex?
Well, it's not surprising at all. I mean, I think this modification of the document itself is kind of stupid and silly, especially if you can't match the font right. It seems very amateurish, and so I think it's more of a red herring than anything else. But what I think is very telling about this, though, is that every single party involved with these leaks seems to have their own theory about how they came about, and they're spinning the information. So, for instance, you have Ukraine coming out and saying, well, we think Russia's behind us. We think they stole the documents and they somehow got them out there. And Russia is saying, well, this could be Western disinformation. And they're also saying, and if they're legitimate, then this indicates that, you know, we were right about the great extent of NATO and U.S. involvement in the Ukraine war with Russia, right? So that, you know, they're meddling in these affairs, even though Ukraine's not a NATO nation. You know, NATO is really, really meddling here. And the United States has come out and said, well, we don't know where the hell these things came from, right? So, you know, everybody's got their own take and their own version and spin on the facts here. But I think that modification, you know, was obviously done by somebody who was pro-Russia, but also technically inept. I mean, there are much better ways of doing this.
Well, or they just had a small monitor and they were in a hurry.
Well, it definitely points to amateurs as far as trying to make something look better, not really a professional at work here.
Well, but what is professional to my mind is the fact that we're dealing with photographs of the documents themselves. Because you think about, how did Reality Winner get caught, right? She printed a document from an official printer, and using some kind of dot matching system, they were able to identify that, you know, she was the source of this particular leak, right? You know, and that's how, you know, and there was some big controversy with that, right? Where she gave these documents over to The Intercept then posted the documents without protecting their source, right? And she was able to have been identified. So it seems like these documents, to my mind, if we're dealing with photographs of documents in some kind of bizarre setting with a hunter scope and Gorilla Glue in the background too, I mean, that's just, you know, also very odd. But because we're dealing with photographs of documents, it indicates to me that the person who had possession of these documents might have actually printed them from an official government source. Because I would be, if I were leaking documents, and I never have, I used to have access to, you know, classified information. I would never, ever remove classified information from any facility. But you would imagine that today, if someone were doing that, they certainly would not want to have a high-resolution scan of that particular page, or they wouldn't want to have any kind of original files that came out of, let's say, you know, a SCIF or anywhere in the intelligence community. So taking a picture of the document itself and degrading the resolution of it in some ways is a protective measure to mask whoever printed it, whoever was the source of the actual document itself.
Of course, there are dangers in taking a picture. You could have geolocation data attached to the photograph.
Well, that's very easy to remove, though. I mean, there, it's easy to turn it off when you're taking the picture, and it's also really easy. That's data called EXIF data that's associated with that image, and it's very easy to manipulate that data or to remove it from any particular file.
Yeah, the generations of those photos are going to be really interesting, and not just location, geolocation, but also like what type of camera or what type of phone, right, what type of network carrier, if any of that information was somehow like something you were able to surmise, and then the geographic location. If you don't have exact coordinates, you could narrow down a lot of that stuff, mm-hmm, and then like piece things together of other knowns. And that's, I think, what nobody has a full picture of, and it will take time, is like just getting what the facts of the situation are. And then they're probably also scrambling to take some vacations and move some people around, because this is affecting a lot of the current activity. And I think also thinking the thought about piecing it together will be about motivations. You know, what right, what are the motivations at play? And because, as Alex kind of pointed out, I mean, the professional nature, I mean, I think it's, I don't know, one way to describe it, but it's the desirability of this information, the tense moment and high importance, mm-hmm, in this particular environment.
There seems to be an agenda, and it seems to focus on Ukraine, because that's all I've heard about are documents related to that. If there are other documents related to other things going on, they haven't been given the same amount of attention. So it seems that whoever did expose this is doing it for some kind of a reason. Now, why, and maybe Alex, you can speak to this, why they would store it on a Minecraft Discord chat for months. Is that just maybe a safe, I guess it is a safe place because nobody discovered it, but is that something typical?
No, I think it's really strange. I think it's very strange. I mean, and I would presume that other people would have access to that particular Discord chat, you know, that channel, that server, whatever the hell it was. And so the fact that these things were hanging out there, possibly, you know, just unnoticed, I think is really, really odd, right?
Well, I mean, it's a bunch of 12-year-olds that play Minecraft, right? I mean, right. I know adults play as well, but it's predominantly kids. Do you think it's possible that they didn't know what they had, or could this be somebody who, you know, saw it in his dad's briefcase or something?
Well, maybe. I think there's any number of reasons about how you could explain this. I don't necessarily know, but if we're thinking of that this was some kind of intentional act, then perhaps an explanation would be that whoever was behind this uploaded these files to some random Discord server where people aren't necessarily going to understand the import or the significance of these files. Then after a certain period of time has passed, maybe they understand how Discord works and how they discard, you know, log files or information about who uploaded what when. After a certain period of time has passed and they know that that information has been erased, then all of a sudden that information is put back into the public domain, you know, by another emissary of this particular information, another conduit. At that point, they can then go back and say, well, I found this on a Discord server, you know, and it checks out because there it is on this old Discord server. But the metadata that would be associated with who uploaded this file might be gone, might be erased. So maybe somebody has some inside knowledge about how Discord handles data retention. I don't know. That's a theory. Yeah. I really have no idea.
But hiding in plain sight and allowing it to be sort of found eventually buys time for someone and is a way of keeping it so that it's available and you can disassociate, and I guess they're able to think of, you know, get an escape plan or something. I mean, just basically distance themselves from the actual distribution method.
It's one hell of a story. It's really something. It's interesting. I don't know. Maybe I'll start playing Minecraft now, finally, because I didn't know there were all kinds of hidden treasures like this that you could find. But let's predict. Alex, do you think they're going to catch this person? If so, what kind of a time frame, and any hints as to what methods they might use?
Well, they're definitely going to be using search warrants, subpoenas, interviews, trying to assess what was going on with Discord servers, any kind of data that they have that would lead back to who these individuals were. But the other aspect of this, and I think this is also something that Bellingcat had covered, which is that there seemed to have been way more documents out there that were shared on a separate Discord server, something called this Thug Shaker Central, that used to be run by somebody by the name of Vaki. So it's, I guess the Thug Shaker Central server was originally named after its original founder, one member of the server with the username Vaki. And this guy, Vaki, apparently knows or claims to know the identity of the person who was the original source of these leaked documents on the Discord servers, and that there were many other documents, perhaps, that were shared on this Thug Shaker Central server. So all of this, I think, maybe it doesn't make sense because somebody who, or maybe the parties behind this, have created such a smokescreen here that they don't want any of these dots to connect. I mean, that's
exactly
what I think here is like, you get this weird Thug Shaker Central thing, which has like 20 people talking about racist tropes and memes and sharing, you know, strange conservative things. And oddly enough, they're also into, Orthodox Christianity in this channel. And then you combine that with Minecraft and then 4chan and Telegram. So, you know, it becomes so obfuscated that the timeline itself doesn't make any sense.
Does any of it make sense, Alex? The whole thing is so baffling sometimes.
What does make sense, though, is like what I said earlier, the fact that we're dealing with photographs of the documents themselves. That's what makes sense to me. That's what makes me think that we're dealing with something that has authenticity here. And I think the fact that the U.S. government is taking it so seriously means that these documents were authentic, and that if you think about who would have had access to these particular types of documents, you're probably talking about somebody who works in the intelligence community, either a contractor or an employee, because these documents were at the TS level, the top secret level, and I think some of them were TSSCI level, or sensitive compartmented information, and go up into higher levels. I think some of it was signals intelligence. And so I think we might be dealing with somebody who has a very high security clearance, access to lots of documents in the intelligence community, and that's a very wide range of people, too. So I think back to the time that I had spent in the intelligence community, and I had TSSCI, and you know there were things, you know, big document repositories, something, you know, where you could look at intelligence from lots of different sources and examine it, and that was by design, right? And so obviously, what you're going to be doing if you're the U.S. government is going to be tracking and tracing who touched any one of these documents, who accessed them, when were they accessed. And there's going to be data trails and audit trails associated with who was accessing and touching and printing those documents.
Yeah, they have a different side of all of those documents and can, like you said, authenticate and verify what was published when. And that's kind of what I mean, that like little bit of a time frame, that narrow time frame from their publication, which the investigation side of it will probably have ready access to all the details of in you know, whatever form is appropriate and so forth. So that's all going to be something that is part of the picture, the overall picture that they're going to be building and that we're talking about and describing here.
Well, it'll be interesting to see how this is dealt with. I understand it's already had an effect on Ukrainian plans for military action in the region. If certain things are let out of the bag, well, obviously you have to change your plans, and there's quite a bit of that going on right now. So it's going to be interesting next couple of weeks, I think. Alex, did you have something in closing?
Yeah, I think this is has a very negative impact on the U.S. intelligence community. And in particular, the sources that it has in Russia, because a lot of these documents indicate that, you know, we were able to identify early on the moves that the Russian military were going to make and then relay that information over to Ukraine. So that information coming out of the bag and being publicly known and obviously now is known to Russia is going to have them hunting for whoever was relaying information, whoever is the source of those leaks. And they're going to take extra special precautions to make sure that their future planning procedures do not involve any unnecessary persons. It's going to be much, much harder, I think, to collect intelligence about Russia's moves. So I see this as very much harming the United States and also providing an advantage to Russia.
Well, maybe look towards the Republicans. Just kidding. Or am I? The most interesting account I was able to find about this, again, comes from bellingcat.com, from Discord to 4chan, The Improbable Journey of a U.S. Intelligence Leak. Worth reading. Speaking of leaking intelligence, or maybe just dropping intelligence, ahead of President Joe Biden's speech today in Northern Ireland, local police lost a document that detailed sensitive security information related to the president's visit. A local resident is believed to have found the document on a street in Belfast. A local law enforcement official confirmed the authenticity of the paper on the condition of anonymity. Not sure why, but okay, fine. The document contained names of Belfast police and postings, but nothing related to the Secret Service's operations, which oversees the president's security during foreign trips or its security plans. So that's a bit of fun, losing a document on a street. I mean, that's... That's good old-fashioned incompetence, I guess. Okay, turning it a little bit lighter, I had an interesting conversation over the past week with Google Bard.
How's that going?
It's going okay. You know, we had a rough spot, but I think we patched it up, and we've been on good terms. For those who don't know, Google Bard is yet another one of these artificial intelligence creatures that you can have conversations with. And since you use your Google account to talk to it, it remembers you. Yeah. I was asking it, because sometimes I forget, about the magazine that I edit. I wanted to know how long we've been publishing, and it told me. It said 2600, the Hacker Quarterly, has been publishing since 1983. Well, okay, I can tell you 1984 is when we started, but whatever. I guess we were planning it in 1983. That must be what you meant, right, Bard? It was founded by a group of teenagers in New York City. Yeah, we weren't teenagers. We were in our 20s. Yeah. Well, who told you we were teenagers? Including Emmanuel Goldstein, who is still the magazine's editor-in-chief. Okay, thank you for that. The magazine is named after the 2600 hertz tone that is used to access payphones without inserting a coin. Yeah, not quite right. That's not that, you're describing a red box. 2600 hertz was used with blue boxes. It's a whole other thing. No time to get into it right now, but... Continuing, 2600 covers a wide range of topics related to hacking, including security, privacy, technology, and culture. It often features articles written by hackers themselves. Well, who else is going to write them? As well as interviews with security experts and other thought leaders. Thought leaders?
That's some jargon. That's a buzzword if there ever was
one. I don't think I've ever heard that before.
We're all about our thought leaders here.
I want that on a business card. Emmanuel Goldstein, thought leader.
Thought leader.
Yeah. The magazine has been influential in the hacker community, and it has been credited with helping to popularize the term hacker. Okay, a couple of things here. I would hope that we're somewhat influential in the hacker community, being a hacker magazine coming out in this period of time. But we had nothing to do with the popularization of the term hacker. It's because the term existed that we became a hacker magazine. What we have been doing is defending the term from ignorami who misuse it and refer to every instance of theft and crime as a hack when it's not the case. Okay, now it gets interesting. Go ahead, Alex.
I think the plural of ignoramus is actually ignoramuses.
Well, you would know.
I think it's Greek as opposed to Latin.
I apologize for my ignorance on the phrase.
Ignoramus. Or actually, I think it comes from the verb, but I think, yeah. Anyhow.
Can we just say dumbasses? How about that? Does that work?
We can say that.
All right.
Moving along.
In 2012, 2600 was the subject of a documentary film called 2600, The Hacker Quarterly.
Wait.
This is the first I've heard of this.
That got greenlit?
No, seriously, Kyle. The first I heard of it was through Google Bard. So apparently there's a documentary film called 2600, The Hacker Quarterly. The film was directed by Nadia Hallgren, and it explores the history of the magazine and the hacker community. And we'll get back to this in a second, but just finishing up about the magazine. 2600 is available in print and online. The print edition is published quarterly, and the online edition is updated regularly. Okay, they're both quarterly because it's the same magazine. And the final sentence here, another surprise, the magazine is available in both English and Spanish. Again, that's news to me because we don't translate it into Spanish. So if somebody out there is doing it, please share it with us because we'd love to have it available in Spanish as well. Great idea. But thank you, Google Bard, for your creative recounting of the facts here. So I immediately asked Google Bard to tell me more about the film 2600, The Hacker Quarterly. And it was very very eager to comply. 2600, The Hacker Quarterly is a 2012 documentary film about the magazine 2600, The Hacker Quarterly, and the hacker community. The film was directed by Nadia Hallgren and produced by Alex Gibney. The film explores the history of 2600 from its founding in 1983. Yeah, Google Bard's going to stick to that. To the present day. It also interviews a number of people associated with the magazine, including its editor-in-chief, Emmanuel Goldstein, and several prominent hackers. The film was well received by critics who praised it for its insightful look into the hacker community. It was also a commercial success, grossing over $1 million at the box office. You know, sometimes we just get so caught up in our lives that we don't realize that there's a documentary film carrying our name out there, making money and getting high marks from critics. My face is red with shame for not even knowing about this 11 years afterwards. 2600, The Hacker Quarterly is an important film that provides a unique perspective on the hacker community. It is a must-see for anyone interested in hacking technology or the history of the internet. I would say it's a must-see for anyone that puts out the damn magazine. Should know that there's a film with the same name. Here are some reviews. They actually have reviews. A fascinating and thought-provoking look into the world of hackers. That's the New York Times. A must-see for anyone interested in the history of the internet. That's the Washington Post. A timely and important film that sheds light on a misunderstood community. That's the Los Angeles Times. I looked up every single one of those quotes and could not find them anywhere. These are completely made up. Google Bard made these up, attributed them to newspapers, and is passing this off as fact. So, you know, before we start freaking out about artificial intelligence and how it's taking over the world, there's a lot of lying going on here, you know, unless I'm completely off the mark. And there is a film out there that somehow was very popular that we never heard about that carries our name.
Well, this is the thing they sort of describe as hallucinating, or it's almost as if you asked it to write a story about a movie review, or write a movie review with those, like,
but that's
but
not
you
what
didn't
I asked. Prompt,
you didn't at all.
No,
right?
In fact, it volunteered information. I asked about the magazine. It volunteered information about the film. Then I asked about the film, and it gave me all these details. Never said this is, you know, my imagination, or, you know, I'm on LSD right now. It basically just related all this as if it were true. And I continued to ask more questions. When was 2600 The Hacker Quarterly released? Where did it play? Came right back with 2600, The Hacker Quarterly was released in 2012. It was first shown at the Tribeca Film Festival on April 22nd, 2012. It was then released in theaters on July 27th, 2012. The film was also released on DVD and Blu-ray on October 16th, 2012. Just making up dates. The film played in a number of theaters across the United States. It also played in theaters in Canada, Europe, and Asia. Here are some of the theaters where the film played. United States, AMC Lowe's Lincoln Square 13, New York City, ArcLight Hollywood, Los Angeles, Alamo Drafthouse Cinema, Austin, Texas. in Canada, Scotiabank Theatre in Toronto, Cineplex Odeon Square 1 in Mississauga, Ontario. In Europe, the Odeon Leicester Square in London, Cinemax X Berlin, Pathé Bagrenal in Paris. In Asia, the Golden Village Grand in Singapore, Cathay Cineplex in Hong Kong, and Cinema Paradiso in Tokyo. Okay, and just to kind of wrap this up here, who was featured in the documentary film 2600 The Hacker Quarterly? Bard says the documentary film 2600 The Hacker Quarterly featured a number of people associated with the magazine 2600 The Hacker Quarterly and the hacker community. Some of the people featured in the film include Emmanuel Goldstein, the editor-in-chief of 2600, Kevin Mitnick, a former hacker who was convicted of computer fraud and sentenced to 5 years in prison, John Draper, a former phone freak who was known as Captain Crunch, Cory Doctorow, a science fiction author and blogger who was a vocal advocate for digital rights, Bruce Schneier, a security technologist and author who is considered one of the world's leading experts on computer security. The film also features interviews with a number of other hackers, including members of the Loft Heavy Hackers. Yeah, Loft Heavy Hackers. That's their new name. And the Cult of the Dead Cow. And finally, what production company released the documentary 2600 The Hacker Quarterly? The production company that released the documentary was Jigsaw Productions. It's a documentary film production company founded by Alex Gibney. The company has produced a number of award-winning documentaries, including Taxi to the Dark Side, Enron, The Smartest Guys in the Room, and Going Clear, Scientology and the Prison of Belief. And these guys actually exist. And, you know, I'd be honored to have a film made by them about us, but I think they'd be as puzzled as we are right now as to where this came from. The very last question I asked was, where can I see the documentary 2600 The Hacker Quarterly? And listeners, take note. You can watch the documentary 2600 The Hacker Quarterly on a number of different platforms, including Amazon Prime Video, Google Play Movies and TV, YouTube, and Vudu, whatever the hell that is. And that's the story of our feature film documentary that we are only just learning about right now. Now, some people have said, could they be mixing this up with Freedom Downtime, the documentary film that you actually did make? Yeah, but that came out in 2000? And that did not have any of the elements that were described here, other than a couple of the same people, but certainly not the production team, and certainly not the the success with the box office or the places it played. So, Alex, what does this tell you about artificial intelligence? You know, it just wings it whenever it doesn't have the facts?
I think the trick there is in the name, right? It's artificial. It's just making things up. I mean, it's totally crazy, right?
Well, it's fictitious. Fictitious intelligence, basically, is what it is.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's obviously going to evolve, and this issue with quotes and making things up is going to have, I think, stronger and clearer parameters around it, because this seems to be one of the most common criticism of these large language GPT-type AI systems. But yeah, I mean, look, I think they're generally untrustworthy. You can't expect them to go out and pull fantastic citations for you without any errors whatsoever. I think that's going to take some time, but the utility in other areas, I think, is beyond question. You know, in kind of formulating and outlining thoughts and arguments and you know, things like that, collecting information, providing a narrative where you wouldn't otherwise have one, it's really kind of fascinating.
Well, my question is, if it's so fanciful in making stuff up like this, and yet another feature that is described is like creating a code or putting the finishing touches on some algorithm or function or math problem, how do you check a math problem? I mean, are people just going to trust this? I mean, or is it getting it right all the time just because it's math and it's going to always obey that?
I think math is relatively easy for a computer to get right.
Right, right. But if this is the system that can't be trusted in certain scenarios with language, but then you ask it something with natural language about something scientific, how do you trust it in the same breath?
What I'm thinking here is, you know, all the kids thinking, wow, I can write a term paper now with this thing. All the professors and teachers living in fear of people doing just that. Well, here's an example of how what you get is not necessarily correct in any sense. And you'd better not rely on this to write your paper for you, because it's just going to spin some tall tales. And you're going to be exposed for the fraud you are if you try to pass it off as your own work.
Yeah, I think so. But I think, to Kyle's point, I think people are just going to get more and more used to this, right? I mean, even just the idea now of searching for information and having to click through and piece together, you know, bits and data points from five or six different websites to try to understand a story or something, that almost seems antiquated in a sense, right? Now we've gotten used to this technology being there that's going to provide some kind of coherent narrative with structure that answers any question that we had. Now, prior to that, what did we do? You quote unquote Googled it. This is how Google became a verb, right? And now you go to Google, right? And it just seems like a goddamn cesspit in a lot of ways to me, because you search for something, you have half a page of sponsored ads, and then you have a whole bunch of websites that have obviously been using some kind of search engine optimization technique to get their site there. So, you know, that first page of search results isn't this grand and clean and useful.
But you know what, Alex, you can tell that that's happening. You can say, wow, this is an ad. This person doesn't seem to know what they're talking about. What does the next one say? You can sort of weigh out what you trust and what you don't trust. What I don't see is just pure fiction being taken as gospel, because you still have the ability to make the choice. Here, though, it's presented as fact when it's completely fabricated. I can't find this fabrication on Google. I don't know where it drew it from.
Well, the fabrication aspect, as I said, I think, you know, that's its biggest problem. You know, it just tends to make things up. I think we're going to have guardrails around that. I think that's going to get better. But right now, yeah, I wouldn't trust it, absolutely. But I would guarantee that you'll probably get more accurate results if you're searching for information from something like ChatGPT than you would clicking on some of those sponsored ads that Google is providing you. I mean, some of them are also even, you know, known to be malicious, to not necessarily push out malware, to push you to false or fraudulent sites that might, you know, end up with like a remote access fraud or credentials harvester or something like that. So, you know, I think when one system becomes untrustworthy, another one is going to step into that particular void and will exploit that lack of trust.
I think people should cook something that they get with a recipe and
find
out if it's actually good. Like, that's the
what?
Test.
And sort of a cup of arsenic. No, I don't think, you know.
The machines have taste.
If it's going to lie about this, who knows what it's going to lie about regarding food. Okay, final story for tonight involves National Public Radio, our relatives on the FM dial. NPR will no longer be posting fresh content to its 52 official Twitter feeds, becoming the first major news organization to go silent on the social media platform. In explaining its decision, NPR cited Twitter's decision to first label the network state-affiliated media, the same term it uses for propaganda outlets in Russia, China, and other autocratic countries. The decision by Twitter last week took the public radio network off guard. When queried by NPR tech reporter Bobby Allen, Twitter owner Elon Musk asked how NPR functioned. Musk allowed that he might have gotten it wrong. Twitter then revised its label on NPR's account to government-funded media. The news organization says that is inaccurate and misleading, given that NPR is a private nonprofit company with editorial independence, and it receives less than 1% of its $300 million annual budget from the federally funded Corporation for Public Broadcasting. You know what? If you say NPR is government funded, you'd have to say WBAI is government funded, because we get a small amount too from Corporation for Public Broadcasting, or we have in the past. And this is obviously some kind of agenda on the part of Elon Musk to basically label, as the right wing has done, label NPR and other non-commercial radio networks as leftist, as having some kind of agenda, as being woke, all these things that they love to harp on. But in actuality, it's the same as it's always been. You know, the one test you can run to see if something is government supported or government funded, generally they would support the government, wouldn't they? So when Trump was in power, was NPR any different? Or did they report pretty much the same way they report now? You know, if not, then it sounds like they're independent. It sounds like, yeah, the money might come, part of the money might come from the government, But they are independent, and it's a real disservice to label them this way. Any thoughts, Alex?
Yeah, I want to know how is the BBC labeled on Twitter?
BBC is going through something similar because I don't know what they're labeled as right now. I think they're not labeled at the moment, but I think they had the same label attached at one point. And I don't think Elon Musk understood how BBC worked. BBC works with a licensing fee. Now, you can call that a tax, but it's more publicly supported than government supported. They're independent of the government. At least most of it is. There might be certain parts, like World Service. I'm not exactly sure what the difference is. But some have commercials, some don't have commercials. But it's the public that funds it. It's not controlled by the government. The government doesn't tell them, you have to cover this story. Although, you know, they do cover things in a particular way. Thinking of the recent royal funeral, they dressed in a particular way. They reported the news in a particular style. So you would have a better case, I think, with them. But I still think you would be wrong to label them as state affiliated or government sponsored or anything like that.
And they're not labeled that way. I'm looking at it right now. So NPR does have that label on Twitter as being government-funded media, but BBC is not. Doesn't have any indication of government funding there.
And right after this story came out, Elon Musk tweeted, defund NPR. So I think you know where he's coming from. Or he's trying to be clever, saying, okay, well, if they're not funded by the government, then defund them and see how they react to that. But again, it's a very tiny amount. The remark I made on Twitter a while ago was, well, if you say that, you know, I think it's 0.01%. of their income comes from a government grant. You have to say that Fox News is funded by MyPillow because they certainly get more of a percentage of money from them than NPR gets from the federal government. Hey, we are out of time. Boy, it flew by. But we are going to continue the conversation over on YouTube at 8 o'clock. Just go to Channel 2600 or click on the link at the 2600.com webpage, and it'll take you right there. You can call us. You can participate in various ways, or just listen to more such dialogue. We will be back next week at 7 p.m. here on WBAI, and you can write to us, oth@2600.com. Good night, everyone.
See ya.
WBAI is a local station board, the Pacifica Foundation Board, responsible for local management and operations, is holding its next regular meeting on Wednesday, April 12th at 7 p.m. As events unfold with the Pacifica Network and multiple stations coping with financial weakness, it's important for the LSB to identify and keep up with what local priorities should be. It's essential that the Pacifica Network stations, WBAI included, immediately improve their financial situation and prospects. If we at WBAI fail to distinguish ourselves, increase our donating listener audience, our already shoestring budget and overstretched staff will likely be cut. Vitally important assets may get sold. We are working to ensure that a robust WBAI 99.5 FM remains where the 99.5% can find it on the dial. Again, the LSB meeting is Wednesday, April 12th at 7 p.m. The meeting will be held through the Zoom remote meeting service. The meeting is accessible to the public, and it includes an opportunity for public comment. The fastest and easiest way to join the meeting is by using the link on the Pacifica calendar at kpftx.org and on the WBAI website. You can also access the meeting by calling 929-205-6099. Again, the number 929-205-6099. And enter this meeting ID, 922-457-2995. Again, meeting ID 922-457-2995. And as if that wasn't enough numbers, we also have a password. The password is 995, like WBAI's frequency. So it's 995.995.99. Do you need to contribute to WBAI to access the meeting? No, but we sure hope you do. 212-209-2950 to make a pledge to keep WBAI alive. Thank you.